Now today, we're going to study the book of Ruth. Ruth contains a very lovely story. It's a very heartening story. So those of you who have been coming for the last three times or so, this might be kind of a vacation almost from some of the agonizing issues that we've been dealing with earlier. For example, when we talked about Deborah, you know, women in war, and Hagar, how do, you know, does God treat the slave woman and so forth. Today we have a comedy. It's a story that ends up on a very positive note. The setting is the same setting as the story of Deborah. Around 1200 BC or so, it's during the time of the judges, it says. And that's why in our Bibles, the book of Ruth comes right after Judges, because it's seen as happening during that same time period. Now, in the Jewish Publication Society Bible, or in any Hebrew Bible, the book of Ruth will not come in this order. It'll come at the end in the writing section, and it'll be grouped with four other little documents, little scrolls. They're known as the Five Scrolls, or Megillot. And these are five little books that Jews love and Christians never read, I would say. How many of you have read the book of Ruth in its entirety as a short story? Okay, good. Recently, within the last year or so?
It was the main study for the Lutheran Women's Magazine for January through April of this year.
That's great. That's good. Okay, now these five scrolls in Jewish tradition, each one is associated and read at a certain holiday. The book of Ruth is read at the Festival of Weeks, or Shavuot. We know that festival is Pentecost. That's because it's 50 days after Passover. We say it's 50 days after Easter. And this was traditionally an agricultural celebration. So when we start reading Ruth, we see that it's set during the barley harvest. And so that's one of the reasons that people think that it was read during the Festival of Pentecost. Okay, I'm going to start reading the first part here just because it has some names in it. And once I've done that, then I'll make some comments about it, and then we'll just continue reading the whole thing. I'll ask other people to read today with a little variety, and I think we'll find a lot of delight in the story and get some new meanings about it out of it. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephratites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. When they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Okay, so we're introduced, first of all, in this patriarchal society to the man, Elimelech, and he's from Bethlehem, which is right down here. Because of a famine, they travel, he and his wife and two sons travel to Moab, which is over here. The name of his name of Elimelech means "my God is king." The name of his wife Naomi means "lovely." Naomi, lovely. And the names of his sons, Mahlon and Chilion, are sickly and wiped out. They are not long for the world, you can see from their names. So they travel over here to the land of Moab. Now, if you've studied the book of Genesis, which is, among other things, a kind of primitive anthropology or a study of the history of the development of different peoples, both the Ammonites and the Moabites are seen as the descendants of Lot. And they are seen as Lot's descendants. They were conceived through a trick of his two daughters. When Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, Lot and his family left. And of course, you know, Lot's wife looked back, and so she's out of the picture. So these two daughters are with their father, And they get him drunk and they rape him, and he never knows what happens, you know. But out of this this rape, the two sons, one from each daughter, are born, and these are the Ammonites and Moabites, according to Israelite tradition. So you can see there's a little bit of a negative evaluation already of these two countries. So here they're going over to Moab to find something to eat. Notice that it starts out with the husband, Elimelech, because it is a patriarchal society. They get there, the husband dies. This is a bad situation for a woman to be in Israelite society, because it's so patriarchal in that, you know, the property and inheritance and everything is in the hands of the male. So a woman without a man is kind of in limbo. She needs to have some male to give her some kind of status and security in the society. But her husband dies, and then later her two sons die. So she's all alone in Moab with these two daughters-in-law. Very precarious situation for a woman. Okay, will somebody continue and read 1, 6 through 14? Anybody? You want to?
Then she started with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find a home, each of you in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, so it's just the women there, and things are looking up a little in Bethlehem, so now Naomi's going back. She advises her daughter-in-laws, just stay in Moab. Stay with your families. You get a new husband. Be real. Make a life for yourself. You need to have a husband to have any kind of security. Stay here. You have more chance here. Then she starts going on, you know, do I still have sons in my womb? I mean, it's a little strange for us. What this means is, there was a custom, a practice in that time, if a husband died, leaving his widow, the husband's brother was responsible for marrying the wife of his dead brother and having children, and then those children would inherit the property of the dead husband. So what Naomi's saying is, look, I don't have any more sons. I can't give you husbands from my womb. And she says, I'm so old, there's no way I'm going to have any sons. If I were to have a man tonight and get pregnant tonight, you know, are you going to wait for 20 years? There's no way you're ever going to have any security staying with me. You might as well stay here. Stay here and get a husband. So Orpah says, yes, that's a good idea. She kisses her and leaves. she's a sensible one. And Ruth clings to her. So if somebody would continue reading, we come to a very famous passage. Somebody would read to the end of chapter 1.
Thanks. They broke into weeping again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law farewell. But Ruth clung to her, so she said, "See, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods. Go, follow your sister-in-law." But Ruth replied, "Do not urge me to leave you. to turn back and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus and more may the Lord do to me, if anything but death parts me from you. When Naomi saw how determined she was to go with her, she ceased to argue with her, and the two went on until they reached Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole city buzzed with excitement over them. The woman said, "Can this be Naomi?" "Do not call me Naomi," she replied. "Call me Mara, for Shaddai has made my lot very bitter. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. How can you call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me, when Shaddai has brought misfortune upon me?" Thus Naomi returned to the country of Moab. She returned with her daughter-in-law Ruth, the Moabite. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest.
Thank you. Okay, probably a lot of you have heard that passage, "Do not entreat me to leave you at weddings," right? When I was preparing for this series at home, I told a friend that I was going to do one session on Ruth. And she said, "Ruth's a sexist." I said, "Oh, really?" And she said, "Yes, she says that terrible thing. She says, you know, I'm never going to leave you. I'm going to go wherever you're going to go. I'm going to die when you die, you know, whatever you do." And so she just throws her life away on a man. Well, it's two women. Ruth is proclaiming her loyalty to another woman, a very strange and unproductive kind of loyalty. There's no way that she can gain anything from this alliance whatsoever. It's really goes counter to any kind of prudence in a way. It's just a radical kind of loyalty and friendship. She's never going to leave her, despite the fact that it's not going to get her a thing. So really, it's quite different than my friend thought. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful passage here.
But isn't the key to where she says, "Your God will be my God"? She had lived with this family. She saw what that meant to them, that they had something that her family didn't have.
Yeah, that's part of it, that her God will be her God will be her God. Every people had their own God. There was not this idea that we have that somehow there is one God that's universal for all peoples yet at this time. In fact, some people even argue that the Israelites in the earliest time periods also saw their God as a kind of national God or tribal God, a God that was, you know, had a covenant directly with the Israelites, and other peoples had their own gods too. And it wasn't that these other gods didn't exist, they just weren't the Israelite God, you know. So when Ruth says, "Your God will be my God," she's proclaiming her allegiance. Now this eventually broadened out, and by the time of the Babylonian exile and in the 500s, and especially when you read the writings of 2nd Isaiah, in the book of Isaiah, the last part, starting with chapter 40, there's a new vision, I think, of God, a God that is in control of all history, that there actually aren't different national or clan gods, but that there is just one God. And that's the idea, really, that has stuck, you know. I think there's kind of an evolution of religious consciousness in the world, and we are definitely still within that phase where, you know, there's one, a universal God. So,
Can you explain that name? She says, "Don't call me Naomi anymore."
Oh, sure.
And then the other name.
Naomi means lovely, and Mara means bitter. And notice earlier on, she says, when she's trying to tell her two daughters to go back, she's saying, "No, my daughters, it's been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me." So that theme of bitterness, it's bitter, comes up. She went out full. She had a husband and two sons. Now she's coming back empty. She has no status at all within society. She has no means to make a livelihood, nothing. So it's really a story of two women that are really at sea within this patriarchal society. So let's look and see how they actually do make a living in the next chapter. Mm-hmm.
Since it's a patriarchal society, mm-hmm. is there a chance that she could have had daughters, they just wouldn't have been mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Maybe, but I think the storyline just includes a few characters, and
right.
I don't know. I would just say that she probably only had two sons.
I'm not sure if I pronounced, is it Shaddai or?
Shaddai, that's good, uh-huh.
That is right.
You're reading from the Jewish Publication Society translation, so some of you, those of you who are reading from the Revised Standard Version could compare. Shaddai is usually translated as the Almighty in our translations. Shaddai, I think they made a choice to not translate it because really nobody knows what it means. One suggestion has been that Shaddai comes from the Akkadian word shadu, which means mountains. It also means breasts, similar to the Grand Tetons in our in our language. And so the God Almighty plays on that image of the high, but it could also mean the God of nourishment and be a female imagery. So they decided, well, heck, we're not even going to translate it. We're just going to say Shaddai. But apparently it was a very old name for God because it's usually used in these passages that are reflecting an older tradition.
When it's used with El, like El Shaddai, does that mean the?
Oh, uh-huh. That's a good mm-hmm. good attempt because in Arabic the definite article is El mm-hmm. or Al, but in Hebrew El means God.
Okay.
El means God. So God Shaddai, okay. El Shaddai, God of the mountains, God of the breasts, God Almighty is the way traditionally we translated it. So that means the definite article in Hebrew is Ha. Okay, so let's read how they made a living in this bad situation. Somebody would read 2, 1 through 13. Not everybody at once. Okay.
Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain for him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set forth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to the servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose maiden is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "It is the Moabite maiden who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Pray, let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now without resting even for a moment." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my maidens. Let your eyes be upon the field which they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to molest you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, when I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord recompense you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, You are most gracious to me, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not one of your maidservants."
Thank you. Okay, so what do they do for food? There's a law in Israelite society which actually sets up a welfare system. The farmers, the ones who would own the land and have the means to produce food. They were instructed not to harvest too closely to the ends, to leave some of the grain standing. And also when they were gathering the grain, if some were to fall back in the field, just leave it. Because those with no property and no means to grow any food, they could come out then and they could just pick up the stuff that was left. So that was actually their welfare system. So Ruth goes out and she becomes the provider for the family under this system. She's working among the poor, those that have nothing at all. So you can see how precarious the situation of these two women is. But we also learned that there is a relative named Boaz. So this is an interesting development. We didn't know this before. And he shows a great deal of interest in Ruth. In fact, when they first get together, it's interesting, he says some important things to her. In 11, he says that, you know, everybody knows what you've done for your mother-in-law and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. This reminds us of Abraham, right? Who left his people, his family, and his native land and came to a place that he was unfamiliar with too. So in his words, Boaz is equating Ruth with Abraham, another person who came, left their family. So she's given a lot of honor here. The foreign woman, the Moabitess, the outsider, the woman with no husband is given a lot of status here by this statement. He goes on and says, may the Lord reward you for your deeds, and maybe you have a complete reward. This theme of wholeness is repeated here. She and Naomi are broken women in this society. And he asks for her that, you know, she receive completeness. And this is an important phrase here. The God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. May you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. So God is seen as having wings and protecting those under his wings, much as a chicken would nestle her chicks and so forth. Remember that phrase because it'll show up again at a later point. Okay, so if we could continue here to the end of 2, from 14 on to the end of 2. You good? Thanks.
And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her parched grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. She showed her mother-in-law what she had gleaned, and she also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, Blessed be he by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin. And Ruth the Moabitess said, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my servants till they have finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, your daughter-in-law, it is well, my daughter, that you go out with his maidens, lest in another field you be molested. So she kept close to the maidens of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law.
Hey, thanks. So now Boaz is starting to pull out stuff from the sheaves. He's already starting to recompense her. Right? He continues to show her special favor. She brings about an ephah home. Just for your information, that's about 5 gallons or so of barley. So just to give you kind of a rough idea of what she did in a day. Sort of a sizable amount there. When she gets home then, Naomi asks her, well, you know, where were you? And she tells him about this guy named Boaz. And Naomi gets kind of excited. She says, oh yeah, he's our relative. Hey, yeah, we had relatives. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what the role of the relative was. The whole concept of redemption in the Old Testament, because this is going to crop up now in the next two chapters. In this tribal society, relatives looked after each other. They didn't have the kind of social networks that we have and the governmental agencies and so forth. It was really your family unit that had to look after the interests of the people in that family unit. And so the next of kin was responsible for doing a number of things which fall under the same word. The next of kin would act as redeemer, or goel, for his relative. Now the redeemer in Israel, in the Old Testament, redeemed four different things. One was land. If a family had some land, and then they fell upon hard times and they had to sell the land, at a later period, a relative, a next of kin, closest relative, could buy that land back. So this was to prevent what's going on in this country right now, the acquisition of big, big pieces of land by one person. Because even if the land was consolidated, a member of the family could always have the right to buy it back. So this was land. You could redeem your land for your family. The other, the next one is having to do with inheritance and the continuance of the line of the family through male children. And this is the one that we've already talked about, the Levirate marriage, where the brother of the dead husband would take the widow and they would have children. And then these children would inherit the husband's property. So that brother would act as redeemer for his dead brother's line. So that was another way this idea of redemption was used in the Old Testament. The third way that we aren't going to see in this story, we're actually going to only see these two in this story, is the redemption of a slave. If a person fell into very hard times, they could sell themselves as a slave. And you could also sell your children if you had to. A relative could act as a redeemer and buy the relative, the next of kin, the slave, out of slavery. They could redeem the slave. So this is another way that this word redeemer was used. And finally, in this tribal setting, there was also a redeemer of the blood. And this is related to blood vengeance. If somebody killed one of your relatives, the next of kin was responsible for redeeming that blood. The way you redempt that blood is you killed the other guy, relative, or you killed the one who killed your relative. So this is just a little bit of kind of a word study concerning the concept of redemption in the Old Testament. After these were social realities, the image of the redeemer then was applied to God as a redeemer, one who brought things back to a situation of wholeness and completeness. Yes?
So in Job it says, I know that my Redeemer lives. Is that a double-edged sword at the time, or is it something we have interpreted ourselves later?
You know, that's exactly what somebody asked earlier in the session. I think already he's using a more theological meaning of the term, I would imagine, because it doesn't really fall into any of these categories exactly, but... That's a good question. I don't have an answer. I haven't done a study of that. But it is exactly the same word. I know that my Redeemer lives.
Say that word again.
Goel.
It's not Goel. Like Joel.
No. Mm-mm. Actually, the way you would pronounce Joel in Hebrew is Yoel.
No, they're not Redeemer.
No, huh? Okay. Just wanted to give you that background because we're going to see these two types of redeemer in the next section. Now we come to the really exciting part here, chapter 3. Somebody would read chapter 3. delightful section. Volunteers, nobody likes to read? Thanks.
Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek a home for you, that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maidens you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. And do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had told her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Spread your skirt over your maidservant, for you are next of kin." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of worth. And now it is true that I am a near kinsman, yet there is a kinsman nearer than I. Remain this night, and in the morning, if you will do the part of the next of kin for you well, let him do it. But if he is not willing to do the part of the next of kin for you, then as the Lord lives, I will do the part of the next of kin for you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet.
So, Naomi sets her up on a date. The two women are scheming here. And Naomi has an idea for her, so she tells her, you know, get dressed up very nicely. Go out and do whatever he tells you to do. My mother never told me never. So she does do that, and apparently he's, you know, had some food and drink and everything. And she goes, and it says she lay down at his feet. Once again, the feet, there's a special word for feet, which is the palm of the leg, or the sole of the leg. But actually the word is leg, so she uncovers his, you know, the lower part of his body, which is a little more suggestive, you know, than laying down at his feet. Kind of, when it says lay down at his feet, it's like kind of like a dog, right? You know, lay down at his feet. But she's all dressed up, and she goes and lies down at the lower part of his body. So I guess it would be quite a surprise when you wake up.
And yeah, there some she is. Meaning.
What?
Is this kind of a symbol or a special meaning to do that?
To do that? No, we don't know of really anybody else going and lying down at somebody else's feet. I don't know. It just seems like kind of bold thing to do for a woman, you know.
It might symbolize some things to me if that
happens.
Never have.
You know, it'd be kind of a rare occasion, right? So these women are these women are really taking the initiative and being rather bold here. Now, what I find especially interesting here is Naomi tells her daughter-in-law, go down there, lay down by his legs, and do whatever he tells you to do. And she says, okay, sure, I'll do that. Then she goes down, and she lies down, but notice, immediately she says, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant for your next of kin. She tells him what to do, exactly, when she gets there. And it goes on further, and it emphasizes that, a little later, in 11, it says, and now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. So it's reversed, you know. Naomi says, do whatever he tells you. That's how you're going to get him. She goes down there, gets in the bed with him, and tells him, you are going to, you know, spread your skirt, cloak, wings over me. This is the same word as before. I told you to keep that in mind. Boaz tells her, may the Lord, under whose wings you have taken refuge, recompense you, make your life whole. The wings in that society, kanafayim means wings. It also means the skirts, the lower garments on a person's dress, or, you know, whatever they wore. And so when she says it here to him, it has a little double meaning. You know, she says, spread your wings over me, which has that protective kind of image. But here, at night, on the threshing floor, with the drunk man, or more or less, she says, spread your skirts over me. It has a little different meaning, too. So it's really kind of a risque story, and, you know, who knows, maybe it'll be edited from some live public libraries or school libraries in the future, I don't know. But he's very happy, of course. And he says, wow, this is great that you came to me and not to some young, handsome guy. You know, this is really nice. He says, there's just one problem. There's somebody who's closer in relation to you. He said, I'll be happy to redeem the line, but there's somebody who's closer, so I have to check this out and make it legal. So he tells her to wait anyway until morning. And then he gives her a gift, and this 6 measures or whatever it is, that's about 42 quarts or what, 8 gallons, and they put it on her back. She can imagine her going home with that big weight and showing it to her mother-in-law, who asks, how'd it go? My mother never asked me that, not until before I see her. It's usually, well, what happened? How'd it go? Okay. And the mother-in-law, Naomi, says, you know, this guy's going to resolve everything real quick, so just wait now. We've done our acting. We've done our active thing. Now we have to wait for the legal processes of the society, the patriarchal kind of structures, to sort of be put in place. Okay, so let's continue then and look at chapter 4, 1 through 12. And here it's very interesting. We have recorded a legal transaction in the city gates. That's where all the legal deals and court cases and everything took place, right within the city gates, where the elders of the town would sit, kind of your retired men who had seen a lot. Okay, so would somebody read 4, 1 through 12, please?
All right.
Thank you.
And Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the next of kin of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Then he said to the next of kin, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land which belonged to our kinsman Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here, and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not tell me, that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you are also buying Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of the dead, in order to restore the name of the dead to his inheritance. Then the next of kin said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the matter of attesting in Israel. So when the next of kin said to Boaz, buy it yourself, he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders of all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought the hand of Naomi, all that belonged to Elimelech, and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahon. Sorry, I'm not pronouncing this correctly. Also, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon. I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of all his native place. You are witnesses this day. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you prosper in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. because of the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman.
Okay, thank you. I'm really glad that we haven't kept up that tradition of using sandals for receipts, because can you imagine what your filing cabinet would look like? Okay, so here Boaz gets together 10 guys. He gets his own sort of jury or whatever together there. And the next of kin is called. So it's all going to be done legally right there. In your translation, it calls the next of kin. Boaz says, "Come over here, friend, and sit down, friend." In Hebrew, the word is Poloni, which, and sometimes they say Adoni Poloni, which means Mr. So-and-so. They never even give him a name, you know. "Come on over here, Mr. So-and-so. We have, you know, have a little business to do." And he says, "You know, there's that nice property, Elimelech's, Machlon's, Kilion's property. So why don't you buy it? You know, you can redeem it. You can get it back for the family." So he says, "Yeah, that's a good idea. Land, you know." And so then Boaz continues and says, "Okay, when you buy the land, though, you also are responsible for making sure that Mahlon has children, and therefore the property will go through Mahlon, apparently." And then the Mr. So-and-so says, "I don't think so. It's going to mess up all my, you know, my inheritance and stuff like that. It's not worth it to me. So, you know, you go ahead." So then they do this odd sandal arrangement. If you'd like to read another reference to sandals in the Bible, it's in Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. It's a little bit different, but it still applies. It says, when brothers reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, taking her in marriage, and performing the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man has no desire to marry his brother's widow, then his brother's widow shall go up to the elders at the gate and say, 'My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me.' Then the elders of his town shall summon him and speak to him. If he persists, saying, 'I have no desire to marry her,' then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and declare, 'This is what is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house.' Throughout Israel, his family shall be known as the house of him whose sandal was pulled off." So, although you could refuse, to have children for your dead brother, it was not seen as particularly laudable, refusal, and you got a bad name for yourself. This, in Ruth, doesn't quite go like that, but the next of kin does pull off his sandal and he gives it to Boaz, who then will marry Ruth and act as the redeemer in this story.
Is there any particular reason why Boaz tells kind of half of the deal to the brother or to the relative, and then after the guy sort of agrees, and then he says, "But you have to do all these other things," and then he pulls away his, his agreement. Is there any reason? Was he being tricky, or is that just
What's your reaction to that?
Well, I thought he was being tricky.
Kind of tricky. I think it makes a better story. You know what I mean? I mean it's just such a delightful short story. In a way, it kind of draws it out. You know, because if he just said, "Well, do you want to marry Ruth?" and he said no, and then you know, kind of draws out the whole thing. He says, "Okay, well, there's some land involved." So you know, Adoni Poloni, Mr. So and So, ends up looking like not such a nice guy, right? He says, "Sure, I'll buy the land," but then when he realizes there are other responsibilities, he says, "No, I really don't do that." So I think it's just for literary kind of, it's sort of a tease.
It also shows something about what Boaz wants, I think.
Good
he
point.
He thinks this other guy is going to want the land, so
yeah,
he offers the land first, and then he says, "Oh, but also Ruth."
Okay, good.
So that it may look tricky, but on the other hand, it may look like, well, he gave the guy the best deal. You know, he said, now here's the whole thing, this is what you really want, now there's this other thing. But what Boaz really wants is Ruth.
That's a good point.
But the guy can't come back and say, well, you just told me it was Ruth. You didn't tell me about this land, and I really want that.
Good point.
But if he lived in that society, he would have known that all that came with it.
I know.
Nobody had to tell him.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a story, and then you go, you know, you ask, well, why didn't Naomi go to the next of kin right away, and why did, you know, but it's a story, you know, so it has its own kind of dynamics to it.
I was wondering if, do you know if Boaz already had a wife, or is there monogamy here or not?
There's not necessarily monogamy. We don't know if Boaz had a wife or not. You kind of assume that he did, just because he had property, and you know, you just naturally get married. He was interested in Ruth. I mean, so he liked women, and so
sort of assuming that. It.
Yeah, but yeah. He never says that. You're right. It never says that. And he's an older guy, you know. So you just assume that he does, but you never know.
Available.
Maybe so.
And you know, it sounds like he acted respectably.
Oh yeah, he was
her in this first instance when she laid at his feet.
Yeah, that's right.
And later, it says that they got married.
Right. Yeah, he's a very respectable guy. He does everything, you know, in proper order.
Isn't polygamy a given?
Polygamy's fine.
Isn't polygamy a given as much as? As the dead man's brother is supposed to take the wife, and they're surely not all bachelors out there waiting for their sister's house.
Right. Yeah, in this society, polygamy would be no big deal, you know.
But no, Naomi's rather smart, it seems to me, because she doesn't just march in and say, okay, let's all do the duty, because by letting the story out about what happened with Ruth, and by letting Boaz get to know this woman, he wasn't going to pull off his sandal. She could have run all of her cards out by going at the start. Nobody would want her. I don't know what would happen then.
That's a good point. That the women are, Naomi is very crafty in this story by working, you know, within a patriarchal system, by working and making things happen in her own way.
Well, Ruth proved her worth, too.
That's true.
They didn't just come in as poor widows and say, now take care of us. But we're
good
resourceful.
Yeah, and Ruth is known as a woman of valor. Boaz calls her a woman of valor. Good point.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you go way back to the beginning of the story and the other daughter-in-law, you left the scene, Naomi said, you know, I'm not worth anything. I don't have all this stuff. In fact, she's worth a lot. What was she trying to do to this daughter-in-law anyway?
I don't know.
I think she was still in a period of grief, where you're feeling sorry for yourself and did look pretty bleak.
Yeah. I don't know. That's one of the mysteries of the story, you know, why you don't know about the kinsmen until later into the story.
Wouldn't it follow that if you come back with Moabite women, there's nothing that says that the men would have to do the duty?
Right.
I mean, they certainly could decide that's perfectly acceptable refusal, as one did, in fact, do.
Yeah, I don't really know. There's some evidence that Tamar, who's referred to here, you know, may Ruth be like Leah and Rachel, who built up Israel, and also like Tamar. I've heard it in tradition, and I looked it up in Genesis 38, is where the story of Tamar is. The tradition is that Tamar is a foreign woman too, and the same thing happened to her. Her husband Er, who was Judah's son, died. And so Judah gave her Onan, who was his next son, but he didn't want to take responsibility, so he always spilled his seed, as it says. He practiced birth control, and God zapped him for it. Have you ever heard Dorothy Parker had a bird named Onan? Because he always spilled his seed. Anyway, so then the third son was Shelah, of Judah was Shelah, and Judah did not give her that son because all these sons that she's marrying are dying off. There's, you know, something a little weird here. So eventually she dresses up as a prostitute and has becomes pregnant with Judah, the great patriarch, and just as they're going to stone her for becoming pregnant, she produces Judah's ring, his cord, and his staff, and it says, I'm pregnant with the child of the man who owns these things. And Judah has to say, well, you were right, you were in the right, you you had a right to the sperm, family sperm bank, basically. And I think that, at least in tradition, I couldn't find it in Genesis, she's a foreign woman also, so I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Well, this story comes up, and the story of these foreign women come up in the synagogue where I work, over to the issue of the law of return. Who is a Jew? Mm-hmm. And, you know, theoretically, the religious tradition has it that the mother is the determinant of who is a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing for me is that here in the story, at what point is she Jewish? At what point does this Moabite woman come under the Jewish law?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also an interesting parallel to me that this is a Pentecost festival, and then all the, you know, in the Acts 2 account, all the various tribes and people from all around the world, it's an inclusion and kind of maybe a conversion underlying theme here about who's in and who's out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the main lines of the story certainly is that the foreign woman is in, you know, she's the great-grandmother of David. And as you say, you know, you mentioned that you thought that the most important thing was that she accepted the God of Israel. And in later interpretations of this passage, she is seen as, you know, an early prototype of the convert who should be welcomed in, celebrated, and, you know, who is laudable, I mean, a wonderful, a woman of valor, that kind of thing. So, good points. Let's see, why don't we just finish reading this, and then I have a few concluding remarks, maybe some other people do too. I can finish this since there's a lot of names here. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When they came together, the Lord made her conceive, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the descendants of Perez. Perez became the father of Hezron, Hezron of Ram, Ram of Amminadab, Amminadab of Nashon, Nashon of Salmon, Salmon of Boaz, Boaz of Obed, Obed of Jesse, Jesse of David. Okay. So it's interesting. It ends up with the patriarchal genealogy. It starts out with Elimelech, the patriarch, and the problem within patriarchy. It ends up with the patriarchal genealogy. But it's interesting that in the section right before that, it returns to the women, and we have the women's reaction to the whole thing. Boaz and the Redeemer have been making a deal, talking about land and heritage and property rights and you know, all that kind of stuff. But the women, they come and they say, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin. He shall be to you a restorer of life, a nourisher of your old age." They aren't interested in all this patriarchal stuff. You know, this is a new source of wholeness and completeness. And goes on and talks about the daughter-in-law, who's more to you than seven sons, has borne this child to you. So Ruth, more than seven sons. So in the midst of this sort of patriarchal structure, you have the different values of the women. And I think that besides the theme of the foreigner as accepted and valuable and a good person, you also have this view that within a patriarchal society, which for women would be a very difficult kind of society to live in, an imperfect or a broken society for women, you have a tale of women bonding together and making a life for themselves. And I love this story because I think that although we have a responsibility to change things that perhaps are unjust in the world, there's no way that everything's going to be made perfect. You know, we're not going to have a perfect society. So at some point, you've got to make a life for yourself. And this is exactly what these two women did by being loyal to each other and working within the system to create a happiness for themselves. So I think it's a lovely story. Comments? Questions?
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking that when she said, more to you than seven sons, mm-hmm. seven being a symbolic of wholeness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's right.
That she really did find wholeness.
Mm-hmm. So it really is a story of going from brokenness to wholeness, even within a system that that wasn't necessarily conducive to the promotion of wholeness. Any other comments?
Are there other stories in the Bible which deal with this sort of mother-in-law relationship?
Let me think. Mother-in-laws. I can't really think of anything right now. Are you wondering if it's usually more adversarial? I'll have to think about that.
Jesus.
That's right.
Mother-in-law.
Jesus raises Peter, heals Peter's mother-in-law in the New Testament. So there's one mother-in-law. I don't know. I don't know of any others. Any other comments? Well, we're really out of time, so thank you very much.
Thank you.